From KUOW in Seattle, this is Soundside. I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Libby Denkman. The Colorado River is a vital but threatened water supply, and the communities in Arizona, California, Nevada, and beyond that depend on it face the prospect of having to resort to greater efforts to secure water. Meanwhile, the Navajo Nation is trying to get access to that water, access it's been denied, despite the fact that its lands border the Colorado. It's estimated that almost a third of the 170,000 people who live on reservation land cannot easily get to clean, reliable drinking water. The Navajo Nation has sued the federal government, saying it has kept the nation from fully pursuing those water rights. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Arizona versus Navajo Nation. The court's decision could have significant implications for the water rights of tribes across the country, including here in the Pacific Northwest. Monty Mills is a Charles I. Stone Professor of Law at the University of Washington. He's also the director of the UW's Native American Law Center. Professor Mills, welcome to Soundside.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So, we know the Colorado River as a water supply is facing multiple threats: climate change, a growing population, the demands of agriculture. How big a deal is this case in the ongoing fight for water?
Well, I think it's pretty significant. It's not just all of those clear and present dangers, I think, in the basin, but also the legal structure, the so-called law of the river that was established really in the 1920s and throughout the 20th century was premised on supply of water that simply hasn't borne out. And especially in these times of scarcity and increasing threats from climate change, the expectations that folks had way back in 1922 when they entered into the compact just haven't been the same. And so the legal structure also presents limitations and is really at the crux of this particular case, not just because the Navajo Nation hasn't had access to water from the main stem of the Colorado, particularly in the lower basin, but because that structure has been relied upon by a number of different interests, and in particular, the state users in the lower basin, like Arizona, California, and Nevada, to really establish all the uses that people have come to expect in terms of getting water to Southern California or the Phoenix metro area or other places. So when the Navajo have brought this case, and have alleged that the United States has additional duties to help identify and protect and plan for getting them water, it really highlights those potential shortages and impacts on other users. And that's really where at least the state party to this particular case have said this case could have a really significant impact because of all of the already over allocated existing uses on the system. If the United States has duties to find other water within the system for the Navajo Nation, then those state parties and the other non-tribal interests see this as a real threat.
Yeah, you mentioned the 1920s, but I know this case goes even further back than that. There are two treaties that the tribe and the federal government signed way back in 1849 and 1868. What do those treaties have to say about the government's responsibility to protect the water rights of the Navajo Nation?
Yeah, and that really is the crux of this particular case. And I mean, to be clear, I think arguably the case goes well beyond that into history as well. And Navajo folks and other tribal folks would say back to time immemorial in their presence on the land as well. But certainly those treaties in the 1800s are at the foundation of this particular case. And there's long established precedent before the United States Supreme Court, cases over a century old, that recognize that when the United States reserved lands for tribes, like they did, particularly in the 1868 treaty after Navajo returned back to their homeland from Bosque Redondo, that those reservations came with water necessary to fulfill the purposes of the reservation, even if the treaty didn't say anything about water. As here, the Treaty of 1868 was silent as to water. But what the Supreme Court recognized way back in 1908 was that it would be really inconceivable that the United States and tribal parties to a treaty would agree to establish a reservation and a homeland for particular purposes, whether those be agricultural or homeland or whatever purpose that the parties agreed to. It would be inconceivable that they would agree to do that without the water necessary to fulfill that purpose. And particularly for agricultural purposes, and especially in the Southwest, the court has seen it's necessary. So that idea that the treaty itself came with a corresponding reservation of water is really at the root of the rights that Navajo is asserting in terms of water in the Colorado. And nobody in the case disputes that the treaty reserved those water rights. But what Navajo is also saying is that in addition to that reservation of rights, the United States, as a party to the treaty, also has some obligations, some duties to help identify and protect and even plan for or assess and potentially even deliver actual water to the reservation so that it's not just a legal right recognized under Supreme Court precedent, but as you noted, helps address some of the shortages that citizens of the Navajo Nation are facing on an everyday basis. The United States, on the other side, says, well, we recognize you have a right to water, but we don't agree that there's any corresponding duty on our part to do anything about that. And
this isn't on us, they're saying.
Exactly.
This is, yeah.
Yeah. And they're really trying to draw a distinction between the right to water that Navajo may have and any obligation that the United States might have undertaken in that treaty to do anything to help the Navajo actually get water under those rights.
You know, I'm not sure that any of this would apply legally, but I'm curious, what do we know about how both sides interpreted those treaties back when they were signed in the 1800s? Can we place ourselves in their minds at that time?
Yeah, we can try. And in fact, the Supreme Court has long said that that's how courts in the modern era need to be interpreting treaty language. We have to look at that language as the tribes would have understood it at the time. Fortunately, in this particular case, there's a very helpful amicus brief that's been filed by an association of traditional healers on the Navajo Nation that talk about some of the fundamental tribal values that would have been relevant to the tribe's understanding of those treaty obligations and those treaty negotiations. And that really, I think, has been a powerful statement to help the court understand what the tribe would have understood at the time in terms of what they were agreeing to, what they were reserving, and what the rights of both the United States and the Navajo Nation were at that particular time.
And do we know about the federal government side? Do we know what was in their minds at that time?
Somewhat. I mean, in terms of the language of the treaty, and this is true for treaties across the board, I mean, they are written in the language of the United States, right? They are written in the English language, often pre-prepared by federal negotiators, subject to some discussion and negotiation during treaty meetings. But I think the part of the reason that the Supreme Court has long held and long recognized we need rules for how to interpret that is comes from the fact that really, especially for treaties negotiated in 1868 and sort of later in history, really these were terms that the United States was expecting and hoping for in order to serve broader national interests. And so in some ways, the ensuring that we look at them as the tribes would have understood them, as opposed to or really relying on what the United States says they mean, helps to balance out some of those negotiation differences, the language and cultural differences. But it also helps to just ensure the terms of those original promises, as opposed to saying now in 2023, well, that's just an old promise. And maybe there was much more water available then, but there's no water available now. So we can't really honor that under modern circumstances. And I think that's why, in some ways, kind of regardless of what the United States had expected, they were clearly offering and providing reservation, a homeland for agricultural and other purposes for the Navajo. And the Supreme Court has recognized that comes with water. And really the central dispute here is whether or not that was the end of the United States obligation with regard to the waters that were reserved in that treaty as well.
So moving through time forward up to present day time, the Navajo Nation sued the federal government in 2003 over this issue, saying the federal government has failed to protect our water rights. We know that the courts don't move as rapidly, perhaps in some cases, as we might like. But why has it? I mean, that was 20 years ago, Monty. Why has it taken so long for this case to start to come towards a resolution?
Yeah, well, part of it is, I think, the complexity of the management and the system of the Colorado River, which, I mean, really, this case came about as an effort on the part of Navajo originally, as the United States was making decisions about how water would be allocated in times of shortage, which even in 2003 were on the horizon, but particularly now are critical. The Navajo was really concerned that as that happened, their water rights, which they had a clear legal claim to under the Winters case, that 1908 case, but haven't been adjudicated or quantified or really resolved at all, that their water rights would sort of be set aside while new rules were developed for how shortages would work. And so the complexity of the legal challenges to the United States authority really resulted in this case kind of going up and back and forth among the courts over the last two decades. And importantly, we're only at the stage where the question before the United States Supreme Court is, can the Navajo even bring this claim in the first place? I mean, this is whether the Navajo can file an amended complaint alleging that there is a breach of the United States duties to the Navajo here. So there isn't any evidence in the record about that. There hasn't been a hearing about the merits of that claim. We're not even to the point where a court can really dive into weighing that claim against sort of substantive arguments. The only issue here is whether, as a legal matter, that is a viable claim that the Navajo can bring in the first place. And I think that's, notwithstanding the amount of time that's passed since the Navajo first brought this claim, we're really still at the early stage of this particular issue. And it remains to be seen, depending on how the United States Supreme Court decides that, whether Navajo will even be able to move forward and bring that claim and then have the opportunity to prove the nature of the duty, what it might entail, how the United States can carry that out, and the United States can argue the substance of it on the other side. At this point, the United States is saying, you can't even bring that claim in the first place because there's no legal basis for you to do that.
Meanwhile, the pressures continue to build, right? And the demands on the water continue to grow. I'm wondering, I mean, for some folks listening to us right now, Arizona and disputes over who gets how much of the water coming from the Colorado River, I mean, that just may seem like a long way away from us. But what local issues jump to mind for you that this case could impact here in the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of the broadest level, at least from a tribal-federal relations perspective, the question about what duties come along with treaty obligations and treaty negotiations on the part of the United States is really one that is much broader than just the specific claims that the Navajo are bringing about water here. And whether or not a tribe like Navajo or any tribe can assert that in addition to rights reserved under a treaty, there are corresponding obligations on the part of the United States to either protect or help support or plan or assess or whatever the scope of those rights may be. That is an important issue, I think, for tribes everywhere. And there have been a series of cases about the scope and enforceability of the United States trust responsibility. But this case presents a little bit different nuance to that because here, Navajo is asking the courts to order the United States to do something as opposed to seeking money damages. And so that issue, I think, is relevant for tribes across the country. The other one that I think is really important is the scope of that Winters Doctrine or that 1908 case about reserved water rights. And that's an issue on which a number of tribes, some here in the Northwest, but across the country, as well as the National Congress of American Indians, weighed in on at the Supreme Court in the filing of an amicus brief saying, look, there may be disputes about the duties here. We think there is a duty on the part of the United States to do more than just recognize these rights. But the scope of the reservation of water rights associated with treaties and the creation of reservations, that's an integral part, not just to tribes and tribal interests and protecting their rights, but really to the scheme of water law across the entire American West, where water has been the subject of a number of legal conflicts and conflicts between tribes and states and conflicts between tribes, states, and the United States. But the idea is well settled that tribes have a reserved right based on the establishment of their reservation or based on their treaty reserved rights and activities that water is necessary to support.
Yeah, and when it comes to water rights, of course, it's there are international implications as well. Earlier today, Senator Maria Cantwell and several of her fellow congressional colleagues sent a letter to President Joe Biden. They are asking him to expedite a final agreement between the United States and Canada to modernize the Columbia River Treaty. Knowing that, I'm just curious about what you think when it comes to treaty rights here in the Pacific Northwest. What needs to be updated? What might need to be strengthened from the tribe's point of view?
I mean, in some ways, there's parallels to the historical development of the law of the river along the Colorado River, and the way in which, in many ways, tribal rights and treaties were sort of set aside and ignored as the law of the river was constructed by particularly state interests, but state and federal interests. And all of these rights and sort of reliance interests were built upon that structure. Meanwhile, tribal rights, treaty rights, and reserved water rights, there was no dispute that those are valuable legal claims, but they were just sort of set aside in the context of the buildup of water resources and water rights. And really the West as a whole, I think, is in many ways a product of that particular history and story. And in some ways, I think the Columbia River Treaty and the development of projects along the Columbia, particularly projects that have had significant impacts on salmon populations and the connection between those populations and reserve treaty rights to take fish at usual and accustomed places on the part of tribes throughout the region, there are a set of values and assumptions and policies that were baked into a lot of those decisions about how resources would be allocated and used. And in many instances, all of those policies and values and assumptions either didn't seriously consider or simply ignored reserve treaty rights, tribal interests, tribal values, and the connection, longstanding connections between tribes and tribal people and these resources. And in terms of modernizing or updating the way that those resources are now managed or that agreements are entered into, like the Columbia River Treaty, I think there's really a need to step back and examine the underlying assumptions and principles that led to those agreements in the first place, the impacts that those have had on the resource and others, and meaningfully incorporate tribal voices and values and legal rights reserved in treaties and otherwise into new structures and approaches going forward. And that, I think, is a bigger challenge than simply, you know, updating an old agreement in the same sort of form and function that it has been. And as we're seeing in the case of Navajo Nation, it puts a lot on the table in terms of existing rights and assumptions and reliances that a number of folks have come to accept as, or even sort of take for granted as their own.
Right. And meanwhile, the clock keeps ticking, and we'll be watching for the outcome of this case, as will you as well, of course. Monty Mills is a professor of law at the University of Washington and is the director of the School of Law's Native American Law Center. Professor Mills, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.